And welcome to the Wednesday edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein with you as your host today. So we're listening to the great music of the late Dave Brubeck, who, as you just heard, just died, and just short of his 92nd birthday. Wonderful music from him, and we'll be hearing from a variety of great people today. Got some snow showers in the forecast with snow accumulation up to 2 inches today, and snow showers in the forecast for tonight, accumulation up to 4 inches for tonight. Numerous snow showers in the morning tomorrow, and a chance of snow in the afternoon as well for tomorrow. Snow Thursday night and scattered snow showers for Friday, mostly cloudy skies Friday night. Again, chance of snow all through the weekend as well, as we're heading into that snowy time of year here in Juneau, Alaska. We've got the radio auction coming up on Saturday. We're going to be talking to Jesse Herman Haywood, who's the auction coordinator here, and also be talking to M.K. McNaughton, who's going to be doing Artists in the Wilderness exhibit. That's going to be happening, and she'll be talking to us about that for First Friday as it comes up here on our First Friday, the big First Friday, the December First Friday. Chris Preble is the JWAC speaker happening tonight at the KTOO TV studios. Fascinating speaker and writer about war, the cost of war, the cost of American military dominance. He's written numerous articles and books and is a fascinating speaker about that subject, and we'll be talking to him. Also be talking to folks from Eagle Crest, getting the Eagle Crest report as they head into a snowy weekend. Should be a good one. More music here from Dave Brubeck, and then we'll be hearing from National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The 2012 White House Tribal Nations Conference kicked off at the U.S. Department of the Interior in Washington, D.C. This morning, leaders of the Interior, Education, Treasury, Commerce, Health and Human Services, and Agriculture departments spoke to tribal leaders from across the country. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack highlighted some achievements, including a settlement with Native ranchers and farmers. Vilsack says a sacred site's report will be released Thursday, which is a collaboration between Native Americans and the Forest Service to improve communications about sacred sites and to expand the definition to consider religious, spiritual, and cultural locations.
Do a better job of protecting the confidentiality of those sites so that they can be preserved and protected, making sure that there is a greater awareness within the United States government about the provisions of the 2008 Farm Bill concerning access to those sacred sites, and making sure that we have better training throughout USDA and throughout the federal government so there's a better understanding of the relationship that those sacred sites have to decisions that we have to make.
President Obama is scheduled to address tribal leaders in the closing session, along with secretaries from the Labor and Transportation departments. The closing session is scheduled for 1:30 this afternoon Eastern Time and can be viewed online at whitehouse.gov/live. Half of the wolf hunting zones have reached their quotas and are now closed. That includes the most populated zones in far northern Wisconsin, Mike Simonson reports.
The southern zones are within two wolves of closing, just leaving Zone 3 from Burnett County on the Minnesota border to northern Taylor County with eight more wolves to kill. In all, the state quota is 116. DNR Wildlife Management Director Tom Hauge says that's what's considered what they call the social carrying capacity.
If you're somebody who's had chronic depredation, you're probably concerned about not having a population goal set too high so that you always have that looming over you. And then similarly on the opposite side of a question, if you're somebody who the wolf is your icon of ecosystem health or wilderness, you're wanting to have as many wolves as possible.
Therein lies the challenge in this first modern day wolf hunt. Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission biologist Peter David hopes there will be more science in selecting that quota next year.
For some people, their personal social caring capacity or social tolerance for wolves is zero. They like to see none of the animals in the state. And then there's certainly other people in the state who feel that there's not enough wolves here yet. So the state has selected a number that they consider to be a social tolerance, but I think that reflects some special interest groups that they're trying to accommodate.
David says the tribes would like to see the wolves shot as farm predators included in the quota. Without that, he says there's a risk of reducing the pack size below a healthy number. Hauge, meanwhile, says the hunt has gone well with fewer than expected violations. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson in Superior, Wisconsin.
The National Gallery of Canada is inviting the public to help create art by donating a wool or natural fiber blanket and a story for artist Marie Watt. The blankets will be part of the Seneca Artists installation at the gallery next year. The blankets will be assembled into seven columns, reflecting the Indigenous teachings of seven generations. Blankets can be donated to the gallery in Ottawa, Ontario. During this week in 2010, President Obama signed the Cobell Settlement into law. The $3.4 billion settlement addresses the federal government's mismanagement of individual Indian trust accounts. The settlement was finalized last month. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Kiwanis is accepting artwork for the 2013 Alaska Native Art Auction scheduled March 7, 2013. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Call 907-793-3528 for more information. Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
The KTO Holiday Auction is coming up this Saturday, December 8th. It's a fun event and a great time to get some fantastic gifts, all while supporting public radio. There'll be 200 items, experiences, and gift certificates, all donated by local businesses, including Coastal Helicopters, Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, and Colette Costa. You can check out the full catalog at kto.org, and be sure to tune in to 104.3 FM or 102.7, or stop by the station on Saturday, December 8th, for the KTOO Holiday Auction.
Hey, well, all right, sir, here we go there, and what are they going to give for? I've been $600 down here, now $10, now $25, now $35, now $50, now $60, will they give me $60, now $75, $75, another $85 on the bottom there. There was a boy in Arkansas who wouldn't listen to his ma when she told him he should go to school. He'd sneak away in the afternoon, take a little walk, then pretty soon you'd find him at the local auction barn. He'd stand and listen carefully, then pretty soon he began to see how the auctioneer could talk so rapidly. He said, oh my, it's do or die, I've got to learn that auction cry, gotta make my mark and be an auctioneer. $25 bid, now $30, $30, will they give me $30, make it $30, bid upon my $30.
This is good, right?
Is there anybody in town that does that?
I don't know. We should get them for the auction, though.
That's what I think.
I'm with Jesse Herman Haywood, the auction coordinator, as we're listening to the song. We're like, let's get this guy.
Yeah, no. Is there a local person that does that?
I don't know. Is there something you could... I always felt like I had the capacity to do that if I could just figure out how it works, you know? There must be just some sort of like little technique you'd get at auctioneering. You know, that thing. But five seems to be the 5-5-5. They're always saying 5-5.
Well, we're looking for one if you're interested.
Hey, it's happening Saturday if you're interested.
Give me a call at 723-1884.
If you're that kind of auctioneer. I guess there's live auctions around. There must be that kind of thing. Must be around. I don't know.
There's somebody in this town that's got good voice skills like that.
Hidden talent out there somewhere. Hey, we got the live radio auctions coming up Saturday. It starts at 8 o'clock. There's a little bit of a break, and then it starts again at 3 o'clock. Goes from 8 to 1 and then 3 to 6. It's happening both here at KTOO News at 104.3, also on KRNN at 102.7. Also online. You can listen online as well
yep.
at KTOO.org. And that's where you can go to get the up-to-date catalog, right? That's
yep.
a big thing,
yep.
right?
At www.ktoo.org.
So tell me about the online catalog, why that's important for people to check
the
out.
The online catalog is really important because it has more items. We do the print catalog. You give people a deadline, and you know we end up getting what we get. And then you know the online catalog is the most up-to-date catalog with more items. There'll be 200 items. They'll have pictures of items because... On, you know, a newsprint, you can't give pictures and much description about some of these items. So go online, check it out. You can see pictures. And there's also more information online I can only fit a small amount of text in.
And also all the pictures and all, especially like when there's artwork or there's clothing or jewelry or stuff like that, it's great to see the picture online.
And also I want to say, come by the station or give us a call. We are accepting / encouraging pre-bids.
Ah, very good.
Pre-bids are a really good way to get an item.
So people can come by now.
Come by now. And a lot of times, you know, like when you're listening, you'll get to the item and there'll be a pre-bid for the full amount. And so sometimes, you know, items will go for higher, but a lot of times if we have the full amount on the item, then sometimes we just kind of go with it. And
yeah. All right, so tell me, so people when they tune in, tell me some of the big items that are happening this year.
Well, the biggest item we have this year,
of course,
is a vasectomy.
The vasectomy.
It's a coveted item.
It's coveted. Well, I was the auctioneer on it 1 year, and it was amazing. It was mostly women on the phone.
Yeah, it's a totally necessary procedure.
It was a gift.
A gift.
A gift for themselves.
the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes.
No, that's a big item. And then, of course, Eagle Crest has donated a bunch of season passes.
Very cool.
Another big item that's exciting is Wearable Arts is donating a table.
And
that it will be a hot item because, as I hear, it sounds like they've already opened up sales, but to, is it members only or something like that?
It's members of the Jack only right now, but I think most of the tables are gone.
They're already gone. And then
right.
I think the auction's so they're already selling them. And so it sounds like tables are already sold out. So this will be
especially for Saturday,
a table for the Saturday night show.
Right.
This is a hot item. And I suspect this will go for more than it's worth. So get your pre-bids in on that.
Well, I mean, they did the bidding for the featured table. And it went up really high. I forget how much, but it went, you know, it was hundreds and hundreds of dollars went for that table. So
this is an item that maybe can't be found anywhere else.
Yeah, it's an exclusive. It's a KTO radio auction exclusive.
That's right. You heard it here
first.
Very
nice. I like that.
And then other exciting stuff, Colette Costa has donated her time and entertainment. She's going to be cooking a 6-8 person gourmet meal on her boat.
So this, I was wondering,
was,
like, because we did these, the thing we just heard, and we thanked Colette Costa specifically.
Yeah, that's why she's the bigger donor.
And I was like, well, why are we thanking Colette? Just because of the Gold Town stuff? That doesn't make sense. So
No. Tell
me more about this. She's going to cook a meal for 6 people or 8 people? 6 people?
6 to 8 people.
6 to 8 people on her boat.
Wine and dine. There's going to be alcohol. And she's going to be entertaining, cooking on her boat. It's a, you know, a dinner party.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Now, how much of a blast would that be to bid on that?
It seems like a lot of fun.
And then, like, have you and 7 friends go just raid Colette's boat and have her.
You said raid.
Wait on you hand and foot. Costa! More!
Yeah, I think that's going to be a big item for sure.
I like the idea of that. That's
and then
good.
Other exciting ones, Silver Bow donated, like, a New Year's Eve stay, which is pretty cool. Let's see, Eric Surgeon's donated tickets. Of course, Wings always donates tickets. You know, lots of really fun stuff.
Eric Surgeon's, yeah, right. So that's very cool. Anything else? Any weird stuff? Cool stuff? Stuff that hasn't been in there before? Stuff that...
There's skis this year.
Oh, yeah.
Skis, weird stuff.
I don't know.
You know, everybody's definition of weird is different.
How about things like... let's talk about this. How about things specifically for ladies?
There's some... Well, you know, I don't want to...
What are there? There's earrings.
I don't want to rule anybody out, but I was going to say belly dancing.
There's belly dancing? Okay. I see there's earrings here. That would be. Because I was thinking there could be
there's
things for...
There's some colon hydrotherapy, but I don't think that we discriminate.
That's fine. I was thinking there's things for men maybe and maybe things for women. Like I see here, for instance, there's a skill saw and some bowling. And that might be maybe for the guy in your life.
Actually, that's not a skill saw. That is actually, we changed it. So that's another reason you should go check out the online catalog. There's been some edits.
Okay.
That is a driver, you know, like a screwdriver.
Impact driver kind of thing?
No,
a screwdriver.
Electric.
Oh, okay. All right.
And that could be, that's for everybody.
Sure. That
everybody
is.
Needs
sure.
One of those.
That is. Yeah, yeah. I mean, all these are for everybody. I like a kitchen apron. Now, who's doing that one?
Odette made a bunch of kitchen aprons. They're
Odette
really fun,
makes
though.
Beautiful
I'm
going to
bid on one. I'm excited about that, actually.
I'm excited about that. Everything that she does is always so great. Are there any pies or any homemade pies?
She donated a couple pies. And I would say right now, put pre-bids on the pies, because the pies always go for twice the amount and way before the item even comes up. So pre-bid.
So I bought one last year.
And?
I bought a cherry pie last year, because Heather loves cherry pies.
And you ate it?
And it was a really good purchase on my part. I'll just put it that way.
Okay. thought you were going to say Scout ate it.
No, Scout didn't eat it. No, it was good. She was just
and
very happy.
And I've been regretting it ever since.
No, it was a great purchase, a really good purchase. How about this, a 75-minute massage?
Yeah, there's a handful of massages. Those are all also big-ticket items because a lot of times these smaller items go for more than they're worth because people like to get into bidding wars.
I know. Here's a weird one. The monkey balloon. Balloon bouquet.
You know, weird? I don't know. I think it's pretty normal and fun.
I think that's practical.
It's really practical. Practical for any occasion. No, Balloons by Night Moods is what they're calling themselves now.
Yeah.
They also donated a pinata. They're going to make a pinata, which I think is kind of a fun item for parties.
Is there a Heritage thing in here?
Heritage has been amazing, and they've donated a couple gift certificates, $50, or, you know, gift cards, and then... $150 to the roastery, you know, like a credit, so you can just go pick up beans.
Wow.
Which is awesome, because not everybody has time to go to a coffee stand in the morning.
That's like close to a year's supply. Well, maybe I don't know if that's a year's supply, but that's a lot.
It depends on your caffeine intake.
My intake's pretty big, it's true. I probably go through 15 bags a month.
I like it thick.
Yeah, half a bag a day, just gets ground up and put in the French press. On to the next one.
Basically.
All right. Well, so this is very cool. So you got auctioneers lined up. I know I'm on a couple of times.
Oh, really exciting this year. Okay, you're auctioning, of course. Ben Brown and you in the morning are going to kick it off. He's really excited. That's always hilarious.
Fun, yep.
Luke and Patrice are on board and very excited.
They're the A-team.
Ricky D is in.
Nice.
Shona's in. Cheryl and Becky Janes are going to be on. There's a couple secret people I don't want to mention.
Secret people.
Yep.
Secret people.
Wild cards in there. They actually haven't confirmed yet.
Little wild cards. Is this guy in there?
Hey, well, all right, sir. Here we go there. What are
hopefully.
We going to
get
I want that guy
that
to be in
there.
That
could be you at 723-1882.
That could be you. All right, it's all happening. It's a live radio auction. It's happening Saturday, December 8th. It starts at 8 a.m.
8 a.m.
Goes to 1 p.m. Then
There's a small break.
There's a couple hours break, and then it starts at 3 and goes to 6.
It's going to be a really fun event.
Cool thing. It's the twice-yearly event. People wait for it, and it's good, fun radio, and it's also great to participate. And when you do it, the number you'll be calling in if you're trying to write this down, like what number do I call in, is 586-3636. That's the number you'll call in during the auction. We'll set up
the phones and do
it that way.
Great time to support public radio while doing your Christmas shopping.
And you can hear us kind of messing around with the paper. This paper insert is in the Empire. Was it already in, or is it going to be in?
It's already in the Empire. It was on Sunday.
But it was in the Empire Sunday, so grab that and also... check out kto.org for the online up-to-date auction
catalog.
We
really insist you coming by the station on the auction day. That's even fun.
Do it. It's super fun.
Snacks, there's drinks.
All that.
Yep.
It's a good time. And meet local celebrities.
Yep.
Like Jesse. Jesse, thanks so much.
Yep.
All right. Ultravox, Reaping the Wild Wind. A lot of artists are out there doing that. A lot of artists in Juneau do wilderness scenes, but actually doing art out in the wilderness is another thing entirely. MK McNaughton's with me right now. MK, thanks for coming in. And there's a really cool thing you're doing for First Friday, Art in the Wilderness. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know what? Now tell me about it, because I had you on the wrong microphone. There you go.
I was very lucky to get to fly up to Kotzebue in late August, early September, and I spent a week out in the Noatak, which is, I was just looking it up, 6.5 million acres big, one of the four parks yeah. that they serve.
It is just that first thing, it's such a fascinating thing to be out in western Alaska. It really does feel like the end of the earth, doesn't it?
It just
really feels like the absolute end of the world.
It just
so
goes on
sparse,
forever.
Goes on forever. The horizon never stops. And it is. It's a life-changing thing to go out there, isn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty easy to move around compared to Southeast with all the trees and shrubs in the way.
Yeah, that's right. Here. That's right. What time of year were you out there?
September. Okay. I feel like they handed me the perfect gift of the cusp between summer and winter. There's about 2 weeks of fall, I think. By Thanksgiving, the sea is frozen there. So I was there in early September, and it was red and orange. And so it was perfect time to be out there looking at the colors. And
well,
I took
like
photos.
Low bush cranberries and all that stuff that's out there. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
A mix of hail and snow and still berries. Yeah, it was great.
Gorgeous. So, and then you took inspiration from this and did works. Is the collection that you're doing all your own work?
It's all my own work.
It's all your stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
And most of it I have made at home since I've returned, because I work in charcoal mm-hmm. portraits of people that are connected to the land, and then mostly paintings, oil paintings, variety of sizes. I have 20 paintings and then 10 little minis, so 30 paintings and
cool.
some portraits and some field sketches.
Uh-huh. And so what about that area and being out there made your artwork kind of, did it change your artwork? Did it change your approach? How, you can tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm a fairly new artist in terms of oil painting, and I've mostly worked in the studio. So for me, being in the field and trying to paint and draw in the field was a new experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I found when I got back to my studio, I was working from photos, and sometimes photos are lacking information. And I pulled out my field sketches and mm-hmm. paintings and drawings, and they gave me the information I needed to do a better painting. So I learned the value of working in the field. Plus, it was just really cool to sit out there in the middle of this hugeness.
Bugs were down by
no
that
bugs.
Time of year.
No bugs.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. It's amazing.
It was quiet, really quiet.
Yeah. Incredible. So tell me about the portraiture that you did out there as well. That's a unique thing as well, being able to kind of grab the essence of people that are out there.
Yeah. I wanted to meet people while I was in Kotzebue, so I volunteered to go into the high school and teach a couple of drawing classes to the high school art students, and that was great. And then I went into the senior center and drew some portraits and talked to people connected to the land. And mm-hmm. I met five people in the 2 hours that I was there at the senior center, and all five of them had great connections to the land. I think everybody in Kotzebue does is connected to the land, and they told me stories. And they were a tough crowd too. I did fast sketches there, uh-huh. and I took photos so I could come back and do longer sketches. They were probably the most wiggly crowd I've ever tried to draw, and the harshest critics.
You're not getting
like
that
me.
Right. Yeah, right.
So I said, well, I'm going to try to do better in my studio, and I've tried, and I have four framed portraits that I will give to the Park Service as a gift, and I gave the portraits that they didn't like very much to the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So these will either hang in the Park Service or go to the individuals. They can decide.
How did this trip come about? What was the inspiration for wanting to get up there?
It's through a program, Artists in the Wilderness program,
mm-hmm.
that's about 3 years old, I think. And a woman named Barbara Leiden, who's a great artist and works for the Forest Service, she started this program. And I think there are 13 sites this year. It's been growing every year that you can apply to this program. You tell them what you work in, show them examples of your work, and
mm-hmm.
then the 13 different sites each pick an artist. And the deal is that I create art, and then they get to pick a piece of it for their collection. So they've picked one of the paintings that
mm-hmm.
they'll hang in their Park Service building, a big, beautiful building in Kotzebue. And they serve four parks there. So I was in the NOAATAC, just one of the four, and they're looking for artists to make art for the other represent the other parks as well.
Okay.
So there are. So I'm going to give a couple of slideshows, and two of the park rangers are flying down for the show and to
talk.
Great.
So this is a project that continues on and has kind of a living life beyond just the artwork itself.
Yeah, it does. I can tell people, if people are interested in learning about it and applying for it, they can. They can come talk to us on Saturday and Sunday at 4.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be giving the slideshow. And I promise it won't be too long. We're going to each talk for 10 minutes. I'm going to have really good snacks.
Yes,
I promise. It won't be. We're not going to trap you in there.
That's all very good stuff. Yes, you got to allow people to know that. Well, tell me about the space that you got. You got kind of a little storefront space there on Seward Street, right?
I do. I rent a little space from Goldstein Improvement Company behind Kenny's, but it was a little bit small for this show. So Daniel Glidman offered me an empty space that's for rent. If anyone's interested in renting it, come check it out. It's on Seward Street 209, Seward Street, in between Subway and the Canvas. And it's a big space. It's going to be great for the show. So there's a big front room with the paintings, and that's where the slideshows will be. And then there's another second room that will be filled with snacks.
Ah.
Yeah.
The snack room, a second. Yeah, that's so very good. All right. Well, sounds great. It's all happening. It's at 209 Seward Street. It's just right up the street from Subway there, in between the Canvas and Subway on Seward Street on that side of the street. It's called Art in the Wilderness, and it's all paintings and portraits from a week that you got to spend up in the Noatak.
That's right.
And it's all by M.K. McNaughton. M.K., thanks so much for coming in.
And can I add, it's 12 to 8 on Friday. I'll be open at noon. Open longer hours than some. And then noon to 6 on Saturday and Sunday, too.
So Friday, stop by for early snacks.
Yeah, I'm going to have snacks all weekend.
And then as it develops into First Friday. Yes, very good. All right, well, thanks so much for coming in, M.K.
Thank you.
All right.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 5th of December, 2012. It's the birthday of Joan Didion, born Sacramento, 1934, whose most recent book, Blue Nights, was a memoir about the death of her daughter, Quintana Roo. She writes about her daughter's struggles with mental illness and drug abuse and the guilt that the mother feels. Joan Didion, who said, "I don't think anybody feels like they're a good parent, or if people think they're good parents, they ought to think again." It's the birthday of humorist Calvin Trillin, born Kansas City, Missouri, 1935, staff writer for many years for The New Yorker and deadline poet for The Nation magazine. It's the 60th anniversary of the Great Smog in London, 1952. London had been famous for its fog for many years. Evelyn Waugh wrote, "The decline of England dates from the day we abandoned coal fuel. We used to live in a fog, the splendid, luminous, tawny fogs of our early childhood. We designed a city that was meant to be seen in a fog." But this one was different. In December 1952, it had been very cold, and so Londoners had burned more coal to keep warm. But on the 5th of December, when the fog rolled in, there was a thermal inversion, and the fog mingled with soot and tar and sulfur dioxide, and it was trapped over the city. And the moisture in the fog reacted to the chemicals and created droplets of sulfuric rain. For 5 days, it hung in the air. The city virtually shut down. At some points, people could not even see their own hands and feet. They were getting lost in their own neighborhoods. It wasn't until the undertakers started running out of coffins that people realized how deadly this great smog of 1952 had been. When it lifted, it left 4,000 Londoners dead, and over the following months, an additional 8,000. And 4 years later, Parliament passed the first Clean Air Act in Great Britain. It's the birthday of Walt Disney, born in Chicago, 1901, who started out making short animated cartoons for movie theaters called Laugh-O-Grams. And it's the birthday of Nunnally Johnson, born Columbus, Georgia, 1897, a short story writer and journalist who went to California to work in the film industry. He did the screen adaptation of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath in 1940 and toned down some of Steinbeck's political ideas. And he gave the Joad family a happier ending in the movie than they had met in the book. Here's a poem for today, a poem by Lewis Simpson, "As Birds Are Fitted to the Boughs." As birds are fitted to the boughs that blossom on the tree and whisper when the south wind blows, so was my love to me. And still she blossoms in my mind and whispers softly, though the clouds are fitted to the wind, the wind is to the snow. Lewis Simpson's poem, As Birds Are Fitted to the Boughs, from The Owner of the House, published by Boa Editions Limited and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering articles from international writers about finances to art, food, wine, and culture. You can celebrate the weekend at subscribe.wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Edwin Starr asking the musical question, war, what is it good for? Well, someone who's done a lot of thought into war and the cost of it and the way our country and economy is built off of war is Chris Preble. And Chris is with us right now. He's the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He's going to be speaking tonight at 5 o'clock here at the KTO studios for the Juno World Affairs Council. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeff Ganas is also with us from JWAC.
Thank you.
Jeff, thanks so much for coming in as well. Chris, welcome to town, first and foremost.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming to our little gigantic state of Alaska.
That's right.
And your first time here, so
that's
I'm
right.
So glad we could serve up some good snow and that sort of thing for you here to go back, tell tales of cold, frozen north. Tell me a little bit about the focus of your talk tonight.
The focus of my talk, it's called Triad to Dyad, and that refers to the nuclear weapons infrastructure. We have three different delivery vehicles going back to the 1950s and 60s. That's bombers, missiles, and submarine missiles. And we looked at this as part of my research going back to graduate school, actually, talking about, do we still need three legs? Could we have a credible deterrent with two or just one? And just to start, it's to consider the history, how we got here, but then also look at the cost going forward because all three of these legs are scheduled to be modernized and in a time when military spending is likely to be flat or probably declining slightly.
It's something we don't, you know, as a layman or someone who doesn't think about this issue much, I don't think about that. You know, I just sort of it's taken as a given. Oh, yeah, we've got these nuclear subs and, oh, yeah, we got these silos and – you know, you don't think about, well, why is it that way? And why do we have submarines with these nuclear missiles in them today, you know,
right.
with given the technology? I mean, that's a fascinating thing just to think about. But I'm guessing that there's a lot of built-in constituency to keeping that rolling the way it is, right?
That's right. As with a lot of things in the government, there's inertia. There are interest groups that become attached to different types of weapons because of where they're deployed. So you have missiles in the Dakotas, you have bomber bases in Louisiana and in California and here. And then the submarine bases are in Georgia and Washington State. Those kinds of things, and then, of course, the people who build them, the new ones, when we do eventually go down that road. The history, you know, is fairly mundane. When it started, of course, there was only one way to deliver nuclear weapons. It was a bomber. That was all we had. But in the 50s, as they perfected the technology, the missiles came online. And then the third part was a missile that could be deployed safely on a submarine, which was at the time really, really quite revolutionary. Over time since then, we've actually improved that technology quite a bit more so that those weapons are as accurate as anything launched from land or a bomber.
And then the money we're talking about is absolutely mind-boggling.
Right. It's hard, actually, to determine exactly how much money goes to the nuclear portion of the budget, partly because some of it's in the Department of Energy, nuclear weapons, some of it is in the Department of Energy, and the delivery vehicles are in the Department of Defense. But it's not unreasonable to think that is several tens of billions of dollars and maybe even more. Even just the new missile submarines that they're talking about building are likely to be $5 or $6 billion apiece each boat, which is, again, just really staggering when you think about it. And in terms of the life cycle of those of that system, it's supposed to be something on the order of $350 billion over the whole life of those of that program, just
and,
one.
Yeah, and then some of the work you've done is just as a scholar to sort of think about, well, this is what we have now. Now, how would is there a way that would work differently or that could work differently? Is there a way that our economy could be structured in a different way?
Right.
Or what would happen if we decided to lower some of the expenditures in one of these three legs? So tell me a little bit about your research there and tell me your findings.
I have done some research in this. My first book was about the drawdown that occurred after Korea and then the drawdown that occurred after the end of the Cold War. And you do see some economic effects. People who had been building after the Korean War things for the Army, like tanks and tanks and trucks, or after the Cold War, missiles and rockets, we obviously spent less on that in the mid-50s and even less in the 1990s. And some places that had become very dependent upon that technology and those jobs did suffer some effects. But what you see over time is that they diversify, they become less dependent upon military employment, and they move into other areas. The place that I studied in the 1990s was San Diego, which is still, of course, has a large mm-hmm. military there, a large Navy base, a Marine Corps base. But much less of their employment is driven by the defense sector.
But you end up with communities where people are highly educated and technically skilled, and then those
Correct.
Things can pretty easily be matched to other
– Exactly.
Not that there's not a period of transition.
There is
I would
a period
think.
Of transition,
right.
absolutely. And it also is in the sense of recruitment. New engineering graduates coming out of college, they go – instead of going into working for a defense contractor, they go into the internet business or they go into medical technology and things like that. Again, that is as to be expected, and that's what happened in a lot of these communities in the 1990s especially.
Well, you've got a real breadth of work. Some of your other titles that I've just kind of been reading in your little bio talks about exiting Iraq as well.
Right.
Tell me about some of your work there.
The first thing I talked about when I came to Cato back in February of 2003 was the Iraq War. My colleagues and I were some of the very few people in Washington who were arguing against the war after the war started. We were arguing for why we shouldn't stay. I wrote a book in 2004 making the case for why, you know, leaving aside the decision to go in, which was a fight we attempted and lost in terms of the argument.
Amazing to think it's been 10 years.
Right, right.
It's incredible, really, when you think not quite, but almost 10 years
almost
now.
Almost 10
yeah,
years.
Right.
You know, I think that tragically we have learned some very important things in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. You know, we have this exceptional military. The people who serve in our military are so dedicated. They're so professional. They want very much to do good, to do right. But sometimes even the best intentions go awry, and I think we've seen how that's played out in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I also think helps to explain a little bit why there is much greater reluctance or at least a kind of prudence about using force in the future, especially when we're talking about tens of thousands of U.S. troops on the ground.
Well, I mean, I think the dedication and intentions of those people is why it's so beholden on us as citizens
exactly.
to hold our policymakers and leaders accountable for using that force.
That's
I mean,
exactly
that's
right.
an incredible, important thing that we have to do. Jeff, we'll talk with you just a second here, a little bit more, Chris. But, Jeff, tell me a little bit more about the Juneau World Affairs Council, other cool events you guys have lined up. You always have such great speakers. So tell me about a few of them.
Well, thank you, Andy. We have a rich program of speakers throughout the fall and the spring season, winter, and also Tuesday night travelogues, which occur at least once a month. Sometimes several Tuesday nights a month. And you can check our website, www.jwac.org, for the latest postings we have for activities. And we do have a speaker next Wednesday, Jack Perkowski, and he will also be here at KTOO Studios at 5 o'clock for filming as well.
Well, very cool. And we should mention that, Chris, your speaking tonight will be carried on 360 North. And
that's right.
We're really excited here at KTO and 360 North to be able to provide speakers like you statewide. You'll be up in Anchorage again tomorrow.
Tomorrow I'm speaking in Anchorage. That's right.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about some of the other things that you might be covering during your speaking tonight.
Well, I am going to talk about the history of the weapons development and the some of the key figures, some of the kind of iconic figures like Curtis LeMay and Bernard Shriver and Arleigh Burke, who's
you see
the
this
chief,
all going over my
chief
head,
naval
right?
operations. These guys, well, we name ships in the Navy. We name ships
okay.
after famous admirals. So Arleigh Burke has ships named after him. But these are some of the folks who were responsible for developing these again, transformational technologies. But so much of it is now based on people don't understand the history of it. They don't understand how we got here. And when you talk about that and you realize that it was driven by technology that now has been superseded, and it also was directed at an adversary that thankfully went away a long time ago, the Soviet Union, that was a legitimate concern, obviously, at the time. But what we're talking about today, again, the wars we just talked about, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously no one contemplated using nuclear weapons in these wars. That would have been unthinkable on so many different levels. And so in the wars that we actually fight, these weapons are truly useless. Not that they don't have a deterrent effect. They do in terms of large-scale wars, and I think they do have a role to play there. But we could have a very credible nuclear deterrent with far fewer weapons than we have even today, and the arsenal already has been cut about one-tenth of what it was at the high point.
It is an incredible thing that we have this huge infrastructure built up to create these things that we know will never be used.
That's right.
That just will sit.
That's right.
And then what do you do with them? And then there's this massive problem of what what
correct.
Then?
Right. The cleanup obviously associated with the weapons labs, the weapon facilities, the manufacturing facilities is a legacy, a very costly legacy of the Cold War, and we're paying those prices. We'll be paying that price for a long time.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got so interested in this subject.
Well, my dissertation, I studied history at Temple University in Philadelphia, and my dissertation was on the politics of weapons development in the 1950s and 1960s. I wrote about the missile gap. This was the debate between John F. Kennedy and the Eisenhower administration over how to compete with the Soviet Union. A lot of that research, I did publish my dissertation as a book, but then I moved into other things. So I'm kind of returning to my roots. In fact, I've dusted off some old file folders from graduate school and of course, learned about the new work that's been done over the last 20 years.
What have you been working on in the meantime?
Well, obviously at Cato, I did work a lot on the contemporary wars, mm-hmm. the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I still continue to write about nation-building, counterinsurgency, things like that. And now most recently we have done a lot of work on the economics of military spending, how you transition from a very high tempo military posture, which is what we've been involved in over the last 10 or 15 years, and likely moving to a different posture over the next 10 or 15 years. Certainly we hope so. And we think that the military spending is likely to come down slightly. And if that happens, what would the force structure look like in the future? I think it would be probably fewer active duty personnel, fewer troops in the Army and Marine Corps, a bit more responsibility put on the Navy in particular, and to a certain extent on the Air Force.
Among people like yourself who have some influence or are scholars in this area and maybe part of think tanks and other things like that, is there a trend that people are talking about? Is there sort of a hot debate about
yes.
what the future holds?
Yes, there is. I mean, when I started this work, again, I've been at Cato for 10 years. We have always been arguing for a smaller military that was more focused on a core set of missions as opposed to some of the things we've been doing over the last 10 or 15 years. Interestingly, over the last 2 or 3 years, more think tanks in Washington have come around to the view that, as a matter of fact, yes, we are spending more than we should. We are doing more than we should. If we are serious about focusing our resources and our attention on the truly essential things, then that will require us to spend less on the Pentagon and to ask our troops to focus on a narrower set of missions. And it has started to change over the last 2 or 3 years, interestingly.
Is there a hot topic or number one thing that people talk to you about or want to know about, people maybe in the general public that want to know about when you're doing speeches or talking to folks?
Right now the hot topic is sequestration, the fiscal cliff. This is the cuts in particularly in military spending, but it's also divided evenly between domestic discretionary spending and defense spending. But there's a lot of concern, especially in communities that are heavily dependent upon military spending, like Maryland, Virginia, Southern California, Texas. They want to know what the impact is going to be. And so that's where, again, my research into how we've done this in the past and what has actually happened helps to, inform, I hope, this debate. Because, yes, there will be some transition effects without any question. But ultimately, we are a stronger country if we're investing our resources in the most productive part of our economy, which is the private sector, which mm-hmm. is where true job creation and job growth is and should be.
So what's the next hot spot? What's the big danger spot out there? I mean, North Korea, is that right. it? Or what's the next, you know, what, from your perspective, what are the areas? And I guess as part of that, what's the exit strategy on Afghanistan or what's going to happen there? Is that part of that?
I think Afghanistan should be a big topic of discussion. We obviously have still tens of thousands of troops on the ground. And while the president has said the combat mission there is going to end in 2014, we still don't know what the long-term plan is. Will we have troops on the ground after 2014? How many? Under what conditions? That's a huge area of focus in Washington, I think appropriately so.
This whole thing of you go into an area, I think that we have, you know, from a civilian standpoint, we have this rather simplistic view. Our troops are going to go in. We're going to fix that country. Right. We're going to leave. And, hey, why are we still in there?
Right.
You know,
right.
I thought that was fixed. I thought we overthrew that government. Let's get out of there now.
Right.
And that's this.
recall Colin Powell's statement that when you break it, you own it. That's part of the challenge, of course, is that if we take on a responsibility, when we overthrow a government or are responsible for its overthrow, what additional obligations do we incur? I think that has induced a greater caution today than perhaps 10 years ago.
That's a hard lesson to learn there.
Lesson, yeah. A costly lesson, obviously. But I think in terms of other hotspots, what's happening in Syria is tragic, and I think a lot of people are focused there. There are some serious questions about what exactly the U.S. government, the U.S. military could be doing, because I think that there are not a long list of kind of acceptable options there, and I think there's likely to be a greater pressure or at least attention on other countries in the region playing a greater role. Turkey's played some role there. I think they're likely to do even more. Obviously, they have a very serious refugee crisis on their hands. It's bordering, you know, it's right on their border. But other countries in the region are worried about that as well.
Is there an area, Syria's one that you mentioned, we've heard about that. Is there an area out there that we're not hearing about right now that you or people that are in your field are thinking, people don't know about this, right. But there's something really serious happening over here that's trouble.
Well, there's a region that I think we should be paying a bit more attention to, and that's Mexico and Central America, what's happening in terms of the drug violence and the drug war down there. My colleague Ted Carpenter has just written another book on this subject, actually his second on this subject.
And you think that could turn into real larger unrest? And
yes. Thankfully, the Mexican government is fairly stable and the institutions are quite strong, but some of that drug violence is moving into Central America, where the governments are less able to compete, frankly, with the drug cartels. I think they're starting to ask some very serious questions about the strategy, the prohibition strategy. We know what happens when you make things illegal.
Well,
violence comes with it.
What's so interesting about this is that this is something that the U.S. has a direct relationship with, has a direct potential cause for this happening,
right.
Is because we're the market that
That's
they're
correct.
Trying to supply.
That's correct. But unlike in Prohibition era in the 1920s, where the violence was in Chicago and other cities where the consumption of alcohol was also happening, here we are responsible for the consumption, but those countries down south are paying the price. The other big topic, I think, is not a region but a kind of a philosophy of the use of unmanned vehicles and drones. War is becoming arguably cheaper and easier, at least for those who are waging it, not for those who are on the receiving end of it. And we haven't had a real serious debate in this country over what that means, about what oversight is appropriate, what measures are in place to ensure that this instrument of violence is used only in the most exceptional cases.
Because it is interesting. It's almost become this science fiction Ray
yes.
Bradbury scenario of we have a bloodless – we're able on our end to conduct a bloodless battle in which we incur so much damage on the
right.
other end, and it's just someone with a joystick back in the headquarters
correct.
Doing
and
it.
Obviously, right. I mean the people who are responsible take extraordinary measures to ensure that that they are targeting the right people under the right circumstances. But even if they are, in every single case, I think it's important for the American people to know that these kinds of operations are going on and what's the procedure in place to ensure that there's some oversight there.
Well, Chris Preble, I'm not going to make you talk anymore. You've got to talk in an hour here, so I'll keep you from doing your whole talk here. I could talk to you from now on to the end of the show, but we'll let you get out of the studio. And Jeff Ganas from Juneau World Affairs Council as well, thanks so much. Once again, Chris Preble speaking tonight downstairs at the KTO-TV studios, and he is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Chris, once again, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy.
Let's lighten stuff up. What do you say, guys?
Sounds great.
All right. Matt Taker with me now from Eagle Crest. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. We got the Eagle Crest report coming up. You guys are happy right now.
We are.
We're happy.
We could be happier, but we're pretty darn happy anyway.
The last week we were talking about, you know, making snow, and hopefully maybe Mother Nature will come in, and Mother Nature has, and the forecast is continuing to. Now, it hasn't dumped feet and feet, right?
No, and what it has is dumped, once again, this dry blower powder that is great to ski when there's a base, but we're still having issues with a lack of a base. So I don't, you know, we're not set on what we're doing this weekend at this point. We tested some stuff out on Monday, and it is really, really good in some spots and really, really thin in others. So we're not really sold on what we're doing come this weekend, but I'd say, you know, potentially be ready to get up on the mountain, especially if you're an expert skier. I can't, you know, we're not.
Are you angling towards trying to get Ptarmigan open? Is that the hope?
Our goal is obviously to always get more terrain open,
yeah,
safely.
Right.
And you know, the big thing now, what we're saying, is basically durability, is how many people can actually the mountain handle running on a chairlift. I mean, those who have been up hiking and been around the mountain are telling us how great it is. And I there's no denying it. It's fantastic. But will it hold up to a day's worth of skiing? And, I'm not sold on that yet.
Okay, because the snow conditions and also just the amount of snow.
Yeah, yeah. It's really the conditions. It's so dry and so light that it just blows right off. It's not sticking to rocks. It's not packing in.
I see.
Sorts of problems. So
it's the ideal snow for skiing on, but maybe not for early season.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Utah champagne powder, quite frankly.
Right.
I mean, it's not southeast powder,
but the temperatures are supposed to warm up a little bit here as we get towards Friday. It's supposed to maybe get a little bit of that thicker, wetter stuff. So maybe, but that's going to be then on top of this powdery stuff, right? So that's a whole other condition to worry about.
Well, exactly. We're supposed to get a couple inches tonight, I think, into tomorrow, which is great. And then I think actually Saturday night into Sunday is when we'll see a potential of a warm storm that has got snow. As of right now, that's a couple days out, and weather can obviously change. But that's what we're looking to, and that'll play a big part in what we're looking to do. But I'd say, you know, on Friday we'll announce what we're going to do.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm not committing to anything, but, you know, if I was an expert skier, I'd probably get my stuff ready and out of the repair shop and ready to go. I can't say for sure, but it's a definite possibility.
Okay. You guys got events, things planned up the mountain this weekend?
Well, Porcupine will be open again. Last week, Matt had the folks set up a flat down rail and a flat rail. It was pretty cool watching some of them. So we actually had, you know, the beginners getting started on there, and right by their sides we had some of our more expert skiers and boarders as well. So we have some news to announce about that, actually.
Okay, let's hear the news.
This week. So if you haven't heard already, Alaska Marine Lines is sponsoring a terrain park this year. So we're bringing you the Alaska Marine Lines terrain park. It's not going to be huge, so don't set your expectations too high, but we think it's going to be something that's bigger than last year for sure.
Be like the Red Bull half pipe all the way down, just amazing. No.
Not
expectations a little lower. Okay, come on.
Not
but.
Whistler, but it's going to be sustainable, and we think we're going to be able to maintain this model. So we're bringing in some fun boxes, three fun boxes, and really going to emphasize throughout the year some different features, doing some jump things for a while, and then moving on maybe to some rail features. So I'm going to try to mix it up throughout the year a little bit.
What part of the mountain is that on?
It's going to be on the same general area as last year, Lower Ego, out into the flats there. So it'll be on the skier's right-hand side, kind of right underneath the Hooter chairlift.
Okay, yep.
It won't be, you know, that huge jump mound that was there last year, but actual, you know, more of a train park that's got some flow to it. Like I said, you know, we're focusing on getting more features, but making it something that we can continually maintain and improve upon throughout the year.
What are some of your concerns of running that? I mean, that must increase the risk. There's some increased risk when you get into train park stuff, right? What are some of the considerations you have to have
Certainly,
as a manager there?
Yeah, I mean, it adds a whole new element as far as, you know, features we're putting up that, you know, A, people are not really used to. They're not natural to the hill. So we got to take some definite risk management precautions there as far as maintaining it. You know, depending on the snowfall we get, getting somebody out there and making sure before we open it that it's up to standards and what have you. But there's a really a model across the industry now to do that, and we're going to follow that quite closely.
Okay. Is there, like, extra ski patrol, extra stuff like that has to happen around those areas?
I think the biggest thing to focus on here is that some ski areas in the past have tried to put up big features right away, kick it off, and
not really be ready.
And you know, their folks may not be ready. And we definitely have expert skiers and boarders that can handle it right now, but that's not the model we're looking at. We're looking at something, again, more sustainable across the board. So we're going to build things up. This isn't going to be for, you know, the best pros in the world to come, hit our fun boxes here. Instead, it's going to be built so that people can really learn and progress through our system. Again, we have that stuff on Porcupine already set up, so if folks want to start getting a head start right now, early on in the season, they can. And we think that this will be somewhere in the middle so that intermediate to advanced users can use these features and have a lot of fun and actually have a lot of variety at their fingertips as well, but that it's really going to avoid some of those unnecessary injuries that have happened at other ski areas across the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that kind of a reasonable approach. Like, you know, we're a small mountain. We're going to put in this thing, but we're not going to go gigantic huge right off the bat. You know, what's the point in that, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and I will also put in a plug for the fact that we are still looking for a terrain park attendant as from an employee standpoint. So anybody out there that wants to help this thing along and work up at Eagle Crest and spend some time on the hill or all their time on the hill in the terrain park, right. Not riding per se, but helping maintain.
Yeah. Yeah, wait a minute.
Look us up. Check us out on Ski Juno. And the posting's still up there, and we're definitely looking to fill that position still.
You guys still looking for other people as well? Or?
Yeah, you know, we're getting really close to having most of our staffing solved, but still some, you know, rental department attendants, lift attendants are always a hot item, and as well as I think some food service positions as well.
We're looking for one person in particular, though. We're looking for our 1,000th fan on Facebook right now.
Okay.
And if we get there, Matt's going to give him a special shout-out.
You have less than 1,000 fans on Facebook seems crazy.
Yeah, well, we just got started again this year. We had our page go down, and
right.
We switched over from being a person on Facebook to a page.
I know,
and so we're really only a few months into it, but it's been picking up pretty quickly.
Yeah. We're at 999. We need that 1,000th.
Are you really?
Yeah.
The next person is the 1,000th?
I'm watching right here.
Oh, you're watching live. Be the 1,000th like on Facebook for Eagle Crest. I wonder if I already like Eagle Crest.
You better be.
Yeah, no, I'm already on there. All right, so I'm not eligible. Maybe if I dislike and then wait for someone else to like and then I like again.
That's
tricky.
I've seen contests where people have done that.
Yeah, yeah.
If we go backwards next 5 minutes, I know it's coming from you.
Hey, and speaking of contests, you got the Wednesdays happening at Imperial still, right? Thursdays. It's tell me the name again.
Starting at Bad Tailgate Thursday. On January 1st.
Okay.
This is where we're going to kick things off. So folks can come up this year and use the GoPros for free, record themselves skiing and boarding. And this year we're going to add a second element to that. So we're going to have folks that are already pulling their own footage and editing it. They're going to be able to submit video as well. So it should make it a little more interesting. It'll be a second category and some pretty cool prizes, giveaways at the end of the year. I'm not going to preempt Alaskan Brewery on that one, but they're going to give away some cool stuff to our award winners at the end of the year.
So start working those things. Start working on them now. Get your GoPro. Get all that stuff, and you'll be in either category you can get involved in Tailgate Thursdays as well. All right. Anything else from Eagle Crest, you guys?
I think that's about it.
It's looking good.
Yeah, it's
I mean, we're looking there. Good, right? We're getting there. You know, no matter how many lifts are open this weekend, we're looking good. This season's shaping up already.
And, you know, get in the habit this year of checking out the snow report page. It's a new page. And we're going to give you not only the raw numbers, but someone like Matt or maybe our ski patrollers will write an analysis in text of what they think of the snow conditions. And again, we talked about that a little bit a couple weeks ago, but it's going to be honest reporting on that, give you an idea ahead of time what you're looking at before you come up to the mountain. So whether you're coming up on Saturday or in weeks in the, you know, to come, check it out.
Awesome. Yeah, it's going to be great to just be able to check in on there. See what's really happening up on the mountain, to be prepared, bring the right gear and all that stuff as you head up. All right. Matt and Jake, thanks so much for coming in, you guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right.
Do you still sing of the mountain bed we made of limbs and leaves? Do you still sigh there near the sky where the holly berry bleeds? You left as I covered you over with leaves, bits, breasts, hips, and thighs.
Programming support comes from Glacier Gardens, with a variety of Christmas furs, natural wreaths, handmade table arrangements, poinsettias, holiday ornaments, and gifts. Glacier Gardens, open 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily, located in the valley on James Street.
Don't miss the return of King Island Christmas. Adults and the Alaska Youth Choir tell the story of a community that together achieve the impossible. In the Valley at Aldersgate United Methodist Church, November 29th and 30th and December 1st. Downtown for Gallery Walk Weekend, December 6th through the 9th. Tickets at the Jack, jahc.org, both hearthsides and at the door. Or call 586-ARTS for more information. For King Island Christmas.
All right, and hey, an update. Mike Heckers, the 1,000th like on Facebook. Way to go, Mike. I don't know if you win anything, just our appreciation. Thanks so much for doing that. Thanks to everyone and all of the guests today on a Juno afternoon. We're going to head with NPR headlines coming up right now.
Nice. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack.